The book nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Today we're going to go back 20 years to an interview I recorded with Donald McCaig for a novel called Jacob's Ladder. He came out to see me in Yellow Springs. He was on book tour, and I love this interview. Here's Donald McCaig from the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook, and it's my pleasure to have on the program this afternoon Donald McCaig. He has written a new book called Jacob's Ladder. Good afternoon.
Nice to be here.
Donald, you have taken a very circuitous route to arrive here in our studios. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was raised out in Montana, and grew up, went to school there, went to the University of Montana. And when I left, I decided that it's a great dream of all the Western kids, of course, to come east and find out what they've all been warning us against, and possibly indulge in a little bit of that. And so I came to New York City, worked in the advertising there for 8 years, did that, and it was a lot of fun. They paid me too much money for too little work, and flattered me enormously. Which is always kind of pleasing to a young fellow. And I found out I could make a lot of money, which is a nice thing to know. But this was during the 60s, and so a bunch of us went up to northern Maine and built a log cabin. They're just a bunch of ignorant barflies, and dopers was what we were. And I found that I was really happy. I really liked it. And so I said, well, that being the case, why not change my life? And so I did. We went and found a piece of land in Virginia. I mean, just stone ignorant. The neighbors used to drive the pickup trucks past, and they'd stop and they'd back up and take another look at what we were doing, because we just didn't have a clue. We'd be chasing sheep through the porch or something like that, you know. And raising sheep at a sheep farm and writing books, and been doing it for the last 25 years. So that's what I've been doing. I sometimes say, you know, that I don't regret ever leaving advertising, and I generally don't. I think it would have killed me if I'd stayed in it. But the last time I said that to somebody, that night I had this dream, and I was in this production studio, you know, with all the, you know, the mega buttons and all this kind of stuff, and we were mixing for some commercial, and some beautiful girl was planning to jump my bones that night, and a fellow was offering me I think the figure he had in mind was $60,000 a week, so maybe there was some part of me that had reservations about that.
Was this one of the boutique advertising houses?
Oh, sure. Sure, there. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were a lot of fun. I mean, in those days, they didn't work as very hard, and the creative people ran things. I think it's changed now. I think they work those fellows a whole lot harder than they work me, and I think they pretty much tell them what to do too. I don't think they had the kind of crazy freedom that we did.
My guest is Donald McCaig. Donald, you also are a commentator on All Things Considered on occasion.
Yeah, yeah. We provide the filler material when the politicians aren't doing anything. You know, we send up these little snippets, and when they can't think of anything else to do, they put me on the air. You know.
How'd you score that gig?
Well, I like radio. I mean, there's no point trying to work in a media you don't really like. And I like books, and I like radio. I don't like television. I'm not very interested in movies, so there's no point in me writing screenplays, for instance. I got interviewed by Noah Adams for a book of mine, a book, Knopp's Trowels, which is now translated into 12 languages. Last one was Hungarian, I'm pleased to say. And Noah was a wonderful interviewer. And sometime later, he had that program that briefly replaced Garrison Keillor, his Good Evening. And he invited me up, and I was on a show with, you know, I was the minor guest with Lyle Lovett, who's quite a nice fellow, at least he was then. And there was an ATC person there, and I tried to sell them on the idea of I should do some commentaries, and they weren't too keen for it. When I was over in Scotland, I was fairly shortly after that, I was at the international sheepdog trials, and I thought that would make a nice commentary for them. And so I called them up, and I wrote it on the train coming down from Edinburgh, and called them up in Heathrow Airport. You know, they'll pay, I think their motto is, millions for telephone calls, nothing for commentators. But I talked to him for an hour. You know, imagine what a collect call from Heathrow to the States was. You know, I mean, it cost them a fortune. It cost them four times what they paid me for the spot. But I really like to do it because, I mean, I think all our lives are kind of exotic. You know, I mean, we always think that, you know, it's the other fellow's life who's exotic. I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago and was traveling with a friend of mine during rush hour. And I said, my, this is really interesting and exciting. And he turned to me and he says, are you nuts? You know, well, it is if you only do it once in a while. It was pretty thrilling, you know. So I sort of write about life on the farm and the dogs and the sheep and that kind of stuff, you know.
Donald McCaig has joined us in the Book Nook. Donald, you showed up in rural Virginia. You didn't know what it was like to live in a place like this, and you were, according to your press materials, surprised to see the Confederate stars and bars proliferating throughout the countryside, and this got you to thinking.
Yeah, well, what you see, I mean, politically I'm a northern liberal, and but I've lived in the South for 25 years. I mean, I'm going to go to a wedding next month or in June, and it's one of our closest friends, and he was a kid when I first got there. I mean, he was 12 years old, and now he's a fellow who keeps my tractor running. I came to, I mean, not only like my neighbors, but admire them. I mean, they're wonderfully resourceful, honest, funny people. And I decided I was going to do a book on I was going to do a Civil War novel, and I took a couple shots at it, and I'd write 100 pages and send them off to my agent, who would promptly send it back and say, this is really awful. And he was right. It was really awful. I mean, I write a lot of awful stuff. It's just that I throw most of it away, you know. And one day I was down by the river. My neighbors down there like to have what they call deer beer parties, and they'll be cooking a deer up over the barbecue, and we'll be sitting there drinking a little bit of Old Mill or Bush Light, and it's really quite nice, and you know, telling stories about everybody who isn't there. And I suddenly realized, I had the realization that if this were 1861. Then I was sort of like seeing ghosts. I looked at my neighbors and I saw through them, and I saw fellows in Confederate gray. And I said, if this is 1861, these guys would be going to fight for Robert E. Lee. And then so would I. And then it sort of hit me. I said, well, if the whole neighborhood goes to war, you go too. And I would have. But if I might have, that would have meant in my part of the country that I could have been a slave owner. Because most of those fellows in those days were. It was kind of a mark of affluence. It was like your first new car or something like that. But if I could have been a slave owner, I could have been one of my neighbors or my own slaves, too. And, I mean, that, you know, the one thing I'll say about Jacob's Ladder that I will just flat out claim it's a mark of distinction is it's the only Civil War novel I've ever read that takes the lives of blacks and whites with equal seriousness. And I'll just say that I will make that boast and stand by it, by God. So that's how kind of the... And once I could imagine myself doing it, or once I could imagine myself going to war for Lee or running away and ending up on the other side, then I could write the book. I couldn't do anything before that.
ultimately, you discovered a kernel of truth which eventually germinated into this book. This book is based on some real events.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it started. Well, before I got to that point, it started with the I found a court case in the Bath County records. I was researching a book, a nonfiction account, which was called American Home Place. And I found this court case. Couldn't do anything with it in American Home Place, but it kind of puzzled me. And what this was the spring of 1861, and the war was about ready to start. Virginia was about ready to secede. And the whole South was crazy. People were marching at night, torchlight parades. The women were sewing regimental banners and uniforms. I mean, it was about ready to explode, and everybody knew it. Anyway, there was a slave by the name of Jesse had run away from a prosperous slave owner by the name of Samuel Gatewood. And he'd been up in the mountain for most of the winter, and it was apparently a pretty cold winter. And in the spring, he was found in the home of a young white couple who were harboring him. And when they were confronted, instead of being humble and saying, oh, no, it was a terrible mistake, we're going to bring him back in the morning. Oh, we didn't know he was a runaway slave. He said he was a free. And there was a lot of excuses they could have made. And indeed, there was some flavor in the court hearing that they wanted him to make these excuses. But no, they were defiant. And when they went to the slave and said, Jesse, are you going to run again? Now, the correct answer under these circumstances is, no, master, I have learned my lesson. What Jesse said was, it's a mighty big mountain up there. So it puzzled me. Who were these people? Why did they do this? There was a flavor of something really real in here. And it wasn't because there was a lot of abolitionist sentiment in the county. There were in some parts of the South, but in this county it was solidly Confederate. And so they sentenced the young couple to 5 years in the Virginia State Penitentiary. Now, there they disappear from the records. The records were burned in 1865. And Jesse, being a slave, only barely exists in records. You know, I mean, it's only the white folks got in the records in those days. And so I said, well, I wanted to imagine these people's lives. But that was the core of historical fact that kicked off the story. I mean, in the book, they're entirely fictional. I mean, the reasons why I have for Jesse running away and what happened to him was not untypical of what happened to runaways, but wasn't history either.
It's the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. You're listening to 91.3, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. We'll continue with my 1998 interview with Donald McCaig right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on Why So with my 1998 interview with Donald McCaig for his novel Jacob's Ladder. I finished the book moments before you arrived. It's very fresh in my mind, and I'm a big fan of the Civil War. But I think that any reader would find something in this book. Your imagination takes off with these ideas, and the way that you write, you really get into it. I pictured you time traveling to describe some of this stuff in the book. I couldn't believe the detail. When you talk about battle scenes, when you talk about the way people interacted, it really rung true.
Well, one of the things you can—I mean, the big question when you're thinking about it is why not write history? Why write a historical novel? I mean, what's the advantage of a historical novel over history? And the answer is that you can put people there. Now, real good history does it too. Shelby Foote's Civil War narrative can put you there because he's a storyteller. What I wanted to do was put the readers recreate. You know, they put themselves there. All I can do is write a script, or not even a script so much as a score, and that the reader can do. And you give the reader as much help as you can, so that he can do his part or her part in creating the story, because the whole story only occurs inside their minds. You know, And one of the ways you do it, you see, one of the things, one of the interesting difficulties of writing a Civil War novel is that people are very knowledgeable about that war. Your average reenactor is a pretty good historian. Has to be. Knows a lot of stuff. Well, if you get out there and you have something that's wrong, just flat out wrong, you've lost your reader. The reader will instantly jump ship and say, sorry, I'm not interested in that story. The guy's a liar. So getting that stuff accurate is real important. Now, it's fairly easy to get stuff accurate about the battles. If you go back to the original letters, you can find out what the Confederate soldiers were thinking after a particular battle. So you can recreate that part of it. What's hard to recreate, much harder, was what was life like at home? Because they didn't keep those letters. I mean, they kept the letters that the soldiers wrote home, but the letters their wives wrote to the soldiers are generally got thrown away. And by the end of the – and what happened to the slaves? Now, by the end of the war, there were 171 regiments of United States color troops. That's 171,000 men. It's a lot of people. They are invisible in traditional histories. They just really are. And finding out about them was simply and singly the hardest bit of research. I had to do that in the National Archives because there aren't any sources. There's a new book. Another NPR guy by the name of Trudeau has just written about the colored U.S. colored troops. And it interested me because he found the same source I found, and it's the only source, as far as I know, for regimental histories of the United States colored troops in the country. And it's a master's thesis at Howard University. I mean, that's how far you really got to, if you want to find out about this stuff, you got to go pretty deep. And because they didn't write letters home. They had not been taught to read and write, most of them. There are no memoirs by journals from to my knowledge by any member of the United States colored troops except for the 54th Massachusetts, which was freed blacks led by an abolitionist. They were very different than the great bulk of the U.S. colored troops.
My guest is Donald McCaig. We're talking about his new book, Jacob's Ladder. As the book starts, you have a young woman collecting oral history for FDR's WPA in the 30s.
Yeah.
And she is assigned to talk to an elderly woman in Richmond, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And the story begins with this elderly woman talking about her memories. And she is really the link that holds it all together.
She's the spine of the book, yeah. That's exactly right. When you write, this is a very long book. I mean, it's three times the length of a standard novel. That's why I sort of blinked when you said you'd finished it in just, you know, over the weekend. I thought that was wonderful. And one of the things about very long books is that they are essentially is that they need a spine, but the spine is not usually plot. Just think of it for a minute. What is the plot of War and Peace? Pierre finds his soul. The plot of Moby Dick, man hunts fish. Ooh, that's a good plot, you know. Long novels tend to be mostly subplots, the lives of the different characters. And all the different characters have to change because lives do change. And this was a war that changed not only America but the lives of the individuals who were in it. In 4 short years, America changed, and everybody in America changed, and so that gets. So that's going on. Well, but what's the spine? And so it was really this one woman's life that provided that.
Yeah. And her name was many names.
Well, yeah, she had several. Well, she had several names. Yes, she did. I'm glad you noticed that.
Well, she started out as Midge.
Midge, yeah, yeah, and then the slave owner renamed her, which they had the power to do. They could call you anything they wanted, and that became your name.
That was Maggie.
Maggie, yeah.
And then she changed her name again.
Yeah, but I think this time she changed it, or at least she had some say in it, and yeah, she became Marguerite, right?
I thought it was a very interesting twist in the book, her relationship with the slave trader.
Yeah. Oh, I have to tell you something that I found out about 3 weeks ago that surprised me and sort of frightened me a little bit. I deliberately picked throughout, I used the names of real historical people now so that a private in one of these regiments was a private and he was there that day, although he may not be the same as my historical thing. So I decided, well, I was going to have a slave trader in there. And so I figured, well, all right, the easiest way to do that is just name him after a real Richmond slave trader. So there was a Richmond slave trader named Silas Omahundru. And I didn't think any more of it. I didn't find out anything about this particular slave trader, although I found out a lot about the slave trade and how it went on and this kind of stuff. But a couple weeks ago, and Silas becomes attached to one of his own slaves, which happened from time to time. And I was talking to a friend in Richmond. And he said, oh, you didn't know about Silas Omahundru? And I said, well, I know about the fictional character I wrote about. And he says, oh, no. He lived for many years with one of his own slaves. And it was, and she passed for white, and only on his death did anybody know about it. And because on his death, he freed her in his will as well as their 8 children. And I was sitting there saying, whoa, that's a little close. You know, life slides up on fiction sometimes, you know.
This was after you wrote the book?
Yeah, I didn't know any of that. Yeah.
Wow. My guest is Donald McKaig. We're talking about his book, Jacob's Ladder. Reading the book, it becomes clear that the South was totally overwhelmed by the wealth of the North, by the manufacturing capacity. Everything about the North gave them the advantage. So you keep asking yourself, why are they fighting?
Mm-hmm. Well, they thought they could win. And they almost did on several occasions, as a matter of fact. If Lincoln hadn't been reelected, whoever succeeded him would have sued for peace. It was just costing too much. I mean, they were bleeding the Union dry. Granted, it at tremendous self-sacrifice. You know, I mean, the South was getting devastated by this. They thought they could win. And there's one other thing here. Even at the very end, you understand that they were Christians in a way that is much closer to very serious evangelical fundamentalists today, which is to say they really believed that these important matters were going to be decided by God. They really did believe this. And so when they said, if it's God's will win, they meant it. And so that was another thing. And obviously God could have leaned on the Confederate side of the scales had he so wished.
My guest is Donald McKaig. The early years of the Civil War saw some very poor leadership by the Union generals and a lot of victories by the South.
Yeah.
And by 1864, the year that Lincoln ran for re-election, early in the year, you had a situation where the Peace Democrats, the Copperheads, were causing a lot of problems for Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln really doubted that he could be reelected.
Yeah.
And as the year passed forward, things started improving for the Union. Do you think that the key element in his reelection was Sherman taking Atlanta?
Sure. No question about it. And matter of fact, he asked Grant, or Grant intuited that he should try and break the Confederate lines more or less at the same time, and tried very hard, and was repulsed. No, the taking and burning of Atlanta was essentially a political gesture. I mean, strategically by that point, it didn't matter that much. But yes, I do think it was. Oh, I have to tell you a story. The flip of this was Lee's last attempt. He figured that if he could just break Grant's lines, and Grant's lines were 36 miles long around Petersburg, he figured if he could just break Grant's lines, then Grant would have to shorten his lines to hold them, and that might make the difference on the other side of it. So the last attack, last major offensive Robert E. Lee launched was going to be an attack on a place called Fort Stedman, which was just an earthenware, an earth fort on the Union lines. And he got General Gordon getting ready to line it, to lead it. And General Gordon had been fearfully wounded, and he was, to quote a contemporary, as game as a fighting chicken. Anyway, Gordon gets all ready to go. They're all lined up, and this is going to be a big surprise attack. Well, the Confederates along the line, along with the Federals on the line, had sort of adopted this little truce. And the deal was this. We won't use – our sharpshooters won't shoot you, and your sharpshooters won't shoot us. But if anything serious is going to come up, we're actually going to attack you, something, we'll let you know. So anyway, this private comes rushing up to Gordon. They are getting all ready to go. He says, General Gordon, General Gordon, I have this problem. And the general says, what's that, son? And he says, well, we told Billy that if we were going to come, we'd let him know we were going to come. So General Gordon said, son, you just let him know. And so a fellow jumps up on the parapet and says, Billy, we's a-coming. They were a different breed in those days.
Well, it's like in the book, there's the incident where there's just vicious fighting going on around some fortifications, and the Union's really overwhelming the Confederates, and the unarmed officer steps up on top of the battlement and says, I understand you're surrendering or something to that effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, no. Well, we saw a white flag. Well, no, we're not. And then they shot him.
Yeah, 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 they did. That happened, too. That that was probably the worst fighting, the worst single battle of the war. It was, I mean, years afterwards, it was what men remembered. You know, everybody kind of thinks that those soldiers weren't very much like us. Somehow they were miracle men. They didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder and that kind of stuff. Well, as a matter of fact, they did. Somebody else told me fairly recently that when you see the Veterans Magazine, Confederate Veterans Magazines after the war, an awful lot of the ads, the bulk of the ads, were for these hospitals that were offering cures for laudanum dependency. Basically, the year after the war, Mississippi's state legislature's single largest expenditure was for artificial limbs. But it was emotional, too. I mean, some of those fights were horrendous beyond what human beings could stand. The one you mentioned, for years after that, people would the veterans who'd survived at both sides would come back. The fighting got so savage, it was practically 18 hours nonstop, and the whole battle occurred on opposite sides of one barricade. I mean, you had one army on one side of the barricade, the other army on the other side of the barricade killing each other, and that's what happened. And the firing was so ferocious that the bullets cut down a 24-inch oak tree. And for years after the war, the survivors would come back to that battlefield, and that's what they marveled at. They said, we were here, and the bullets were so fierce that they cut down a tree.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today an interview I recorded back in 1998 with Donald McCaig. The Best of the Book Nook continues right after this. You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and an interview I recorded back in 1998. My guest is Donald McCaig. We're talking about his book, Jacob's Ladder. And your accounts of the battles, it's not all about battles, of course, but your accounts, when you choose to talk about a battle, by golly, you really describe it. When you talk about the privations that these Confederates went through and how they would fantasize about what food the Union soldiers might have on them so that they could steal it to eat it.
Oh, yeah. They were when Grant took over. The Confederates were really upset by one of his rules. He had a regulation that the sutlers, who were the sort of the independent contract, independent, you know, they had whiskey and they had food and goodies, couldn't accompany his army. And it made the Confederates furious because they knew perfectly well that if they managed to get in a good, successful attack, then they'd capture the settlers' wagons and they'd get to eat. And no, they counted on Union provisions. And indeed, it was a real issue for them. If they hadn't had it, and a lot of times they probably would have starved to death.
The account of the Confederate soldiers, or butternuts, as you like to call them, waiting for the train at Christmas, and they thought there'd be a Christmas meal on train. That was heartrending to read.
Yeah. Again, the thing about that war that made it wonderful to write about is how many wonderful and amazing and hard that happened. I look at it, and I've been reading from the book from different places, and I look at it, and I'm just amazed, and not at my own wonderful skills, but I'm amazed at how much of it actually happened, because it sounds like it's made up. No, actually happened.
You also give a lovely account of the blockade.
Yeah, the blockade runners, yeah. In the middle of this terrible deprivation, people were getting rich in the Confederacy, and they were doing it because they were shipping out cotton on these boats, which were custom made. I mean, they were the cigarette boats of their time. They're the fastest things in the water. They're very, very low, low freeboard, so that they're practically invisible against the coastline. Some of them they exhausted their steam underwater so that they were silent. And then one of these boats could go right through the blockading fleet in the middle of the night, in the dark of the moon. And it was the cargoes were so valuable that if they ran aground or were driven aground by the Union blockaders, the cargo was worth more than the boat. I mean, people were making fortunes. In the middle of a time when the army was starving, people were making fortunes bringing in brandy and epaulettes and French perfume. It was just amazing.
There are so many things that stand out in this book to me, so many different events. The fall of Richmond at the end of the book, when you have everything burning and the picture to me in front of the bank of the streets knee-deep in Confederate money.
Yeah.
That really said something.
Yeah. Swirling Confederate bonds and Confederate money and the swirling up above the rooftops because of the heat, And
whiskey pouring off the sides of buildings and people drinking it as it came down.
Yeah.
It's just the whole
thing. It was amazing, yeah. It everything in that war seemed to be this enormous exaggeration in some sorts of ways. While the Confederates were starving to death, the port that supplied the Union Army in City Point was the second biggest port in the world. They were unloading 200 vessels a day. They had built an 18-mile railroad to bring fresh bread cooked that morning to the troops on the front lines. And here the guys, 200 yards away, are literally starving to death. It was just this amazing conflict.
Well, it's really a phenomenal story. And the woman, the spine, who ties it all together, Midge or Maggie or Marguerite or whatever you want to call her, her cleverness.
Isn't she wonderful? I mean, she really was an admirable. Yeah. She was just a brilliant woman and shrewd. And I'm not sure she was altogether... you wouldn't want to cross her, I don't think. There's a chapter in there where she describes her business dealings with a banker who's not at all used to having a woman even in his office or in anything other than a totally dependent circumstance. And she has a lot of fun with him.
She pushed him pretty hard.
She pushed him pretty hard, yes.
The book is Jacob's Ladder. Donald, is there a little bit of the book that you might like to read for our listeners?
Sure. Why don't I just read the part of the first page? How about that?
Excellent.
That they'll get to themselves.
Donald McCaig.
Winters were colder in those days. They remembered that. And the apples were smaller and tart, and some of them so orangey they were more orange than red. And every plantation, even the poorest hardscrabble place, grew its own seed corn, so everyone's corn was different, some plump-eared, some long and narrow, some flourished on the wet clay ground beside the river, some did best on the dry limestone hills. The sermons were longer in those days. Those Baptist preachers could get to rolling at daybreak and never miss a lick until supper time. It was a long time before anybody got around to asking them how it was. 70 years, and the young people who came around with their spanking new notebooks to ask questions came, often as not, from the big house up on the hill and bore the same names the old masters had. One remembered seeing the butternut soldiers that first time they crossed into Maryland. She said they looked lean and dirty. She said they looked like wolves. Another remembered Confederate cavalrymen with dead horses' hooves slung around their horses' necks. She understood right away that they cut them off and kept them for their shoes and never forgot the way the bloody things bounced and spattered the living horses next. Some of them remembered the day the general surrendered, how subdued and lost the white folks seemed, and they remembered Cox's Snow. I was 3 years old the winter of Cox's Snow, or that year I was working at Edgeworth Plantation the year after Cox's Snow. Most of them had never learned to read or write, and that was how they remembered things. They remembered that the apples were tart, and people prayed longer in those days, and they remembered Cox's Snow.
Donald McCaig, author of Jacob's Ladder, reading from his new book. I think what came through to me very strongly from reading this book was we live these safe, comfortable lives, and watching these people in the book go through what they went through. Not that wars are good, but by golly, you could sure see what people were made of and the pressure that was on people. These people all reacted differently. Your characters all had different results in their lives from the way that they dealt with the situations they were going through. Now, so many of us never know who we really are because we are not in these situations where we really have to reach deep inside ourselves and find out who are we.
Oh, you know, it's a funny kind of thing. We wish that were true, but I don't know a person. I'm 58, and I don't know a person my age that hasn't met a real tragedy in their life. You know, I bet you don't either. I mean, we like to think that our life, as a matter of fact, goes on pretty easy, and then you, in the back of your mind, there was that time, there was that person, that loved one, that terrible, terrible dilemma. These people, one of the things that's different is that for the people that I wrote about in the Civil War, a lot of it was external. You know, I mean, it was things, you know, if Sheridan's army comes along and burns your farm, you got to deal with it. You didn't cause it, you know, there it is. No reason to feel guilty about it, but it's a disaster, a total disaster. It killed so many. I mean, just flat out, it killed 1 out of 4 Confederate soldiers. 1 out of 5 Confederate generals died in battle. And God knows how many of the colored soldiers died. Tens of thousands. And the thing you can think about, the thing I think about is I think it made us, I think they gave their lives, North and South, free and slave, to make America today. I mean, we are all obligated, and to no matter what our political beliefs, we're all obligated to those people. They tried. I mean, they created the soil of America, I think.
Well, Donald, we're in Ohio, which contributed a lot of soldiers to the Union cause, we're about an hour's drive from Kentucky, and you see a few Confederate flags around these parts.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a very impressive book, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I think a number of our listeners are out there thankful that you could come out and talk to us about it.
Well, it's thanks very much.
I understand that you're married to a poet, and that she was very helpful in this book.
Well, helpful is sort of the nice way to put it. She took the pages of the manuscript, and every time she thought something was she thinks that a bad sentence is morally incorrect, and so she would write. I mean, her favorite comment was patooey. From time to time, she would say triple patooey. I mean, these pages that come back, they just cover with angry handwriting every time. So she basically she sees the world. Poets are on the inside of the language. Prose writers are on the outside. I'm an instrumentalist with language. I don't want you to see the language. I want you to see the event. A poet is lost inside the language, and so she made. One of the things you have to do in a long book like this, and it's an odd kind of thing, and most readers probably don't notice it, is everybody talks differently. You know, depending on your background, where you came from, your kind of habits of life, your speech patterns are going to be slightly different. Well, getting consistent speech patterns for maybe 10 different characters where it mattered, that's hard. It's hard to remember by page 480 what you did on page 37 with this character. And also they've changed. People become war vulgarizes people. People become more vulgar because it's a survival mechanism, you know. And that happened. So that was her biggest use, was her biggest help, was the language of the book.
Donald, I can't say enough good things about this book, so I guess I'll just have to say thanks.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I loved it. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis, and Donald McCaig has been my guest. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for our millions
parting
of
words
listeners?
Of wisdom. Well, yes, I do have a word of wisdom. If it ever crosses your mind that you want to write a great big Civil War story, don't do it. It took 6 years, and complete obsession, and I would wake up in the middle of the night with a pad of paper beside me, not because I was having brilliant thoughts, but because if I didn't write that nonsense down, I couldn't get back to sleep. So don't do it.
Vicariously, I know how you feel. I woke up the last couple of nights totally immersed in the book, actually
really?
Having dreams about it.
Wow.
I really liked it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Pete.
That was Donald McCaig. Recorded back in 1998 on the Best of the Book Nook this morning, and one of my favorite interviews from 20 years ago. He came out to see me that day in Yellow Springs, and he's just a fascinating guy with quite a story and a wonderful book. Definitely worth tracking that down, Jacob's Ladder. And we have just a few extra moments left in our program today, so I'm going to bring you a Best of the Book Nook bonus. About 20 years ago, I had a folk singer stop by who had just published his first novel. His name was Bill Morrissey. He was one of my favorite folk singers, and he was a heck of a novelist. His book was called Edson. He was on a concert tour, and he stopped out here to talk about his novel, and he brought along his guitar. And I asked him, I said, can you play a song that you wrote a long time ago? I love this song. In fact, it's my favorite song by Bill Morrissey. Here's your Book Nook bonus with Bill Morrissey.
This is the first complete third-person narrative I ever wrote. I'd written story songs before, but I'd always throw some first-person in. I didn't inject myself somewhere into it. And then on the last album, I had a couple more of these. I think because I had just spent a year and a half thinking in the third person with the book, the momentum just kind of took over. But this is another winter song. They sat at each end of the couch, watched as the fire burned down so quiet on this winter night. Not a house light on for miles around. And he said, I think I'll fill the stove. It's getting time for bed. She looked up. I think I'll have some wine. How about you? She asked. And he declined. And Warren, she said, maybe just for tonight, let's fill the stove with birches. Watch as the fire burns bright. How long has it been? I know it's quite a while. Pour yourself half a glass. Stay with me a little while. Warren, he shook his head as if she'd made some kind of joke. Birches on a winter night. No, we'll fill the stove with oak. Oak will burn as long and hot as a July afternoon. And birch will burn itself out by the rising of the moon. And you hate a cold house, same as me. Am I right or not? All right, that's true, she said. It was just a thought that she said, Warren, you do look tired. Maybe you should go up to bed. I'll take care of the wood tonight. Oak, he told her. Oak, she said. She listened to his footsteps as he climbed up the stairs. As she pulled a sweater on her and set her wine glass on a chair. She walked down the cellar to the wood box. It was as cold as an ice chest. Then climbed back up with four logs, each as white as a wedding dress. And she filled the stove and poured the wine. Then she sat down on the floor and she curled her legs beneath her. As the fire sprang to life once more, and it filled the room with its hungry light, and it cracked as it drew air, and the shadows danced a jittery waltz like no one else was there. As she stood up in the heat, as she twirled around the room, and the shadows, they saw nothing but a young girl on her honeymoon. And she knew the time it would be short, soon the fire would start to fade. She thought of heat, she thought of time, and she called, didn't even trade.
Bill Morrissey. Bill, every time I hear that song, no matter how many times I hear it, it gives me chills. I mean, it's such a sentimental, emotional song. How do you write songs like that?
Well, that one took 9 years. I was hauling wood up in Maine at a friend's house. And I was living in New Hampshire at the time and heating with wood. And when you heat with wood, you learn the properties of the different types. And I just happened to have four birch logs that were very, very brilliant white. And the image of four birch logs as white as a wedding dress came to me. And I knew there was a song there, but I for the life of me, couldn't do anything with it. I worked on it for 2 years, then put it away. I just was a little frustrated. And then when I was writing the songs for Night Train, I remembered that. And it just kind of popped out in 45 minutes, but that was like 9 years after the original idea.
Is it just me, or are you writing longer songs now?
Some are getting longer, but then again, with the first record, I didn't have any backup, so I didn't take any breaks. And now it's fun if I'm working with horns and stuff just being concerned with texture and tone color. And I had wanted to work with horns for a long time, but I hadn't written anything that was really appropriate for horns. So on the last album, I think I developed a bit more, it's a bit more sophisticated chordally, using passing chords and things like that I never did before. I try to learn something musically in between every record and incorporate that as well as my take on just getting by day to day. So I think every 2 years when I do the records, they're constantly moving or getting better. I hope. That's the goal anyway.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. A little Book Nook bonus for you there, recorded about 20 years ago when the folk singer Bill Morrissey came out here on concert tour, and he had a new novel out called Edson. I love that song he performed, Birches. It always brings a tear to my eye when I hear it. So sentimental. And he was a wonderful guy. He died a few years ago, and I miss him. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening.